position number 12812, rule 3.
Mr. Hanley, rule 3.
The commander raid on Norway, for most of the crew, was the first time the ship, any of them had been in action. Certainly the first time that this particular ship had been in action. It was our baptism, as you might call it. And of course, there was an air of expectancy, a stab of fear, bound to be, you know. But no undue anxiety. The ship, had, in the 2 or 3 months it had been in existence, we'd all learnt to accept orders. Those who were giving them had got the used to giving them and that sort of thing. The spirit of the ship was coming together. The lads had got to know each other reasonably well. We hadn't had too bad weather, so the training had been reasonable. We had a skipper from whom all the atmosphere emanated. He'd only to show himself and put the fear of God in us. Not dreadful, but complete and utter respect. You knew that if he said something, he meant it. And he built up this respect whether the lads liked it or not. He had our complete confidence and respect. And I think we just instinctively knew that whatever we were doing, nobody could do it better. And there would be a reasonable chance of us making our mark. And a reasonable... It wasn't reckless. This was downright good Navy disciplined operations. Anyway, we shoved off the following morning. During the night, I think it was. From Lerwick to Norway, I think, was probably 300-400 miles. And steaming like we were, there was the Queen Charlotte and Prince... two of the Dutch ferry boats who were carrying the commandos. This was one of the first, if not the first, commando raid under Lord Louis Mountbatten. Lord Louis Mountbatten had been made commander-in-chief of the commando brigade when it had moved from combined operations. These were the original commandos as such. I think the Lofoten raid came after the Vagzo, but this was an experiment as much as anything in a quick raid with strength. I think there was a brigade, almost a brigade strength of commandos, and no parachutes. We couldn't drop parachutes. It was winter. And it was 35 miles up the fjords into Norway itself. It was Boxing Day when we expected the Germans, and it turned out to be so. They would be recovering from Christmas and would be least prepared to think that we would be raiding. I remember we went to action stations as we approached the Norwegian, being at defence stations. Then we went to action stations as we approached the Norwegian coast. I was always on duty outside the sick bay because that was the main base for casualties. There was a casualty station in the officer's wardroom back aft, invariably in charge of a petty officer who was in charge of the damage control and what have you. The doctor was free to go where he wanted. Invariably came generally with me because if any injuries or anything happened, it was to the sick bay. The message came immediately. Anyway, there was a door just outside the sick bay lobby which you could go out, and I was on the upper deck getting a breath of air and obviously wanting to see what was happening. Just before dawn, we saw a light twinkling ahead, spot on, and being Captain D was the leading ship of the escort, forward of the troop ships behind us, and the Kenya, the cruiser that was accompanying us as well. And it was a submarine that had fixed her position for the entrance to the fjord. Once we'd lit on to the light of the submarine, we knew we were there, and it was just a matter of hell-bent getting up the fjord. Full speed, more or less, and straight on up the field for an hour and a half at least, and it was just coming dawn. The troop ships then went ahead. We started firing on the factory, the fish factories, and the few ships that were in the port. It was only a small fishing port, factory ships and things like that, one or two German launches and what have you, and started shooting them up just before the commanders got into the landing craft and went ashore in their full gear, you see. One of our boats was lowered and got the two intelligence men ashore, because their job was to get ashore as much as soon as they could, go to any ships or offices and raid them of their private papers, you see. Then they were brought back to the ship later on, you see. Wonderful to see these two blokes going off, you know, right out of boys' own, as I said, to, you know, you felt they were doing something, you were doing something. The guns were firing. Then a strange thing happened. A commando landing craft caught fire. That was washed out. So we had to try and eliminate the fire which was coming onto the commandos as we were going ashore. Then we started to get fired on, not, of all things, by large guns, but by snipers. The shore was all covered in snow. The Germans were in white, so you couldn't see where the snipers were. There was a tree stump, and they just emerged with the background. And I remember the skipper being up there, kind of, where are those buggers? Can anybody see where that flash is coming from? And it was going, everybody was trying to spot where the flash was coming from. In the end, the skipper got the most ludicrous thing, to see a poor 4.5 guns firing on a ruddy sniper. The ludicrous situation to me hit me right off. These bloody big guns, no elevation, firing straight to the shore, trying to find out where the snipers were.
Were many people hit by the snipers?
Ah, yes. The bullets were flying around, and we all had our hard hats on, even sick birth attendants. Any movement on the upper deck, you had tin helmets, you see. And I was sheltering in the sick bay flat when a shout came up, "Sick birth attendant to the upper deck! Sick birth attendant, somebody's hit!" So I go down the ladder on the starboard side, because the port side was being fired on. In other words, we were on the port side of the field. And the bullets were zipping around. And I then crawled to the torpedo tubes, a matter of 30 yards or something like that. You couldn't put your head up too high. And one of the torpedo men who'd been on duty on the torpedo tubes, because all the weapons were closed up, you see, ready for firing, even torpedo tubes, though they wouldn't have fired torpedo tubes, nothing to fire them at. But they were all closed up, and he'd been shot through the throat. I got to him, took his tin hat off, and could see that the hole had gone straight through, and he was dead. Petty officer had come along to see who was in charge of his party, and I said, "He's dead." So we dragged him back under cover, because we ourselves had to get under cover or shelter behind the torpedo tubes or something like that because of this sniper. That's when the skipper started putting the big guns on them, and it quietened down a bit. Shortly after that, a boat, one of our whalers, was coming back. I presume it was the one who dropped the intelligence men off. And they had on board a German prisoner who'd been shot. And also they had on board the whaler, one of the ratings who'd been rowing, had been shot at by the sniper. The bullet had hit the gunwale, where his rollet was, and entered his lung. I think that's how it was. It's such a long time ago. I think it may have been the same bullet that had hit the backside of his chum, hit the metal rollock or something and made a V sign on the backside of his chum and entered his lung, this particular rating. And of course, he was still conscious, very conscious. And this is one of the most awful moments of my life, because as the boat was being pulled inboard on the davits so we could get the rating off, you see, you couldn't start pulling him over the ship's side. You had to get the boat back in so that we could lift him off. And he was conscious. With somebody else's help, I got him onto the deck, and I could see he was very badly injured. He was conscious. Oh, and of all things, don't let me die, Doc. What do you do to a bloke, you know? And I said, all right, come on, though, we'll take care of you. We'll take care of you. But he died. And that was my second death in the Navy. The other being a civilian when I'd been in Plymouth, you see. But you haven't got time to wonder or ponder or anything like that. You're thinking about yourself as well as everybody else, you know. Then they brought a German to me. He was dead. I was reported to the doctor. I said, I got two corpses here. So he came and had a look, and that was the end of that. He went off someplace else, and I was still anxious about other lads that were probably being hurt as well. And as a matter of fact, I think we had 8 casualties. I think we had 4 dead and 3 or 4 wounded. My mind gets a bit hazy on the rest of them. Another thing stands out, though. Those that were dead, we put in the washroom of the ratings, because it was on the level with the waste deck. Put them in the shower on the wooden slats. And my Navy training came in, stripped them, wrapped them in white sheets I'd got from the sick bay. And it seems so ludicrous now. I'd always been taught to what was called stuff the orifices, which I think they still do. Cotton wool up the noses, in the ears, up the backside and things like that. And then tie them up in a sheet. One was a blonde young German. I took his ring off and I gave it to the jaunty, that's the petty officer, who would be responsible for informing the authorities and things like that. But sick berth attendants were not concerned with the dead. The dead were the responsibilities of the jaunties, the gunners, the police of the ship. Well, we had a master at arms and we had a jaunty, and they would invariably get a party who would wrap them in hammocks and they go over the side. So we had about 7 dead on board, and the raid had gone successfully. We had not been attacked by air, because it was 300 or 400 miles away from the nearest German aerodrome, and they hadn't got wind of it. We shot up 35,000 tons of shipping. We took prisoners. We lost a number of commandos and 1 or 2 of their landing craft. We lost no major ships. I don't think any major ships were damaged apart from ordinary sniper fire. Anyway, as we had got these intelligence officers aboard, the idea was then to get out of the field, and the action was finishing then. Everybody had returned to the ships. Get the hell out of it. And full speed ahead, magnificent sight. You should see the greyhound of a destroyer. I could imagine what we must have looked like. It looked grand to me. Going up that field just as the sun was setting in the west, just as it more or less had set. We'd been up there, 7, 8 hours, 35 miles up in the German, in the enemy territory, you know, going hell for leather out of that field to get away, you know, before we started to be bombed. See, got to the mouth of the field, decided to bury the dead, because you can't have dead bodies lying around, obviously. Bad for morale anyway. So wrapped them in hammocks, put them on the quarter deck, ready to push them over the side. action stations, we'd been to relaxed action stations, but enemy was reported again. In other words, we got wind on our radar, I think it must have been, that enemy ships were coming into the field. You know, we didn't slacken speed, and two German armed tugs entered the mouth of this big field, and we shot them out of the water. Didn't take any evasive action, whatever, just blew them out of the water. And there on the upper deck were these dead bodies. I can see it now. And the ship was fighting ship kind of thing. Bloody dead bodies on the quarter deck. Anyway, quietened down. Didn't stop even to pick up survivors or anything. Just had to get out of there and get these men back to Scapa Flow. And eventually did bury them at sea without ceremony. When you're in action, you haven't got time for ceremony. You say a quiet little feeling prayer of some sort, you know. And got these men back to, I think it was Scapa. We went straight to Scapa. I forget now. So that it could be flown to London straight away. And we then got rid of these prisoners where this petty officer was reprimanded, you see. And that was our first successful operation. Within a month or two, we were doing Arctic convoys. PQ-4, I think, was the first. They'd all been very quiet up to then. Then they started to hot up. And Onslow was concerned with almost every Russian convoy from PQ-4 up to the JWs, JW-51B, this one. And in between the Malta convoys, Onslow did two or three Malta convoys, either with distant escort. On one occasion, we went to the Straits of Pantelleria, and we'd taken a convoy, I think, of six ships out of the Clyde, and lost the last one within 200 miles of Malta. Now, can you imagine for 2 weeks or more escorting merchantmen for the relief of Malta, losing them one by one, and you nearly get one there, and you lose that bugger. We lost also Eagle, Manchester, and a Polish destroyer, I think. Time erodes the memory, but these are facts. They may be a bit jumbled up.
Which of those three ships did you see go down? The Eagle, the Manchester, and the Polish ship?
Oh, when you're in convoy, unless you are detailed to pick up survivors, you invariably don't see ships sink, though I have. On the Russian convoys, the merchantmen being picked off, and on this particular Malta convoy, you see the big ships hit, but you've still got to go on. Unless you're detailed to pick up survivors, that's the end of it. Oh, I did see a DSM one.
DSM?
Yes, a DSM, not mine, but one of the ratings. We, on a Malta convoy, I don't know whether it's this one I just mentioned, it was one of them anyway, a fascinating sight, a brilliant Mediterranean morning, the sort of weather you pay hundreds of pounds for to go to the Med now. Blue sea, brilliant blue sea, magnificent sunshine. One or two merchant ships and cruisers, one aircraft carrier and destroyers being attacked by Germans and Italians. Low-level and high-level bombing. Torpedo bombers coming in low. Being at action stations two or three days soon after leaving Gibraltar, you know, exhausted. But this brilliant, beautiful Mediterranean weather, men dying. We were fighting ship, all aircraft, of course. There was no German ships out there, and the Italians, we'd sunk up Taranto, something like that. This was from the western side of the Med. An Italian twin-engine bomber, torpedo bomber, entered the fleet from astern, working on the principle that if he was low enough, you couldn't fire at him because you'd hit your own ships. So he was coming in through the fleet to drop his torpedoes as low as he possibly could get. In fact, the lower the better, because if he was below 20 feet, you couldn't fire at him. You're the next in line, you see, or something like that. This one came along, and he wasn't quite low enough. And on our starboard wing, we had a couple of Oricans, one midships and one on the side of the bridge. And this leading seaman in charge of the Oricon got the range. And every three or four bullets was a tracer. Not every one. And you could see the bright pinch of light on the tracers, so it would allow him to find his range. And suddenly he got it. And you saw the tracer and the bullets flying off this Savoia, I think it's a Savoia, bomber. And down he went into the drink. Couldn't stop, couldn't do anything. You just had to go on fighting ship. But I heard all the crew cheer. You do cheer. Then suddenly, after you finish, it's there but for the grace of God, went yourself. Stands out. Then, I don't know whether it was this convoy or not. We turned tail just before we got to Malta. You couldn't get to Malta. You had to go as far as you could and then hightail out of it. And we were coming back across the North Africa coast so that we were as far away as we could be from the Italian mainland and Sicily, so that the German and Italian bombers would have a bit further to go. And it had just gone dark. And I heard a lot of kerfuffle on the bridge. And our radar had picked up two big ships, enormously big ships ahead of us, you know. Action stations again. It had gone dark, so you'd just gone to defence stations. Everything closed up, and I was thinking, oh, God, where have these bloody ships come from? I heard the skiff say, where the hell have these ships come from? You know, then the navigating officer went in the navigating hut. And after a low, he says, sir, he said, I'm sure I'm right. He says, but it's those rocks off Tunisia. And there's a headland near Bisserta. And there are two big rocks in the sea, you know, a few miles off the coast. Just two rocks. And of course, being hugging the coast, and then suddenly on the radar, these two really big shapes. You think the ships, you see. God, what a sigh of relief that was, you know, all for nothing. Then back to Gibraltar. Another lovely story, this. It'll give you some idea of what life in the British Navy was at that time, and trying to relieve Malta, of being closed up at action stations for 5 days, 6 days probably, because once you had left Gibraltar through the Straits, first of all, you were in sight of Palma, Mallorca, and Ibiza, and places like that, all Spanish but sympathetic to the Germans. The skipper told us the first time he did it, he said, you'll notice the islands on our port side, that's the Balearics, which is Spanish, and it is no doubt that the Germans by this time will know that we're on our way to Malta, you see. That was the first morning. Now, you had 2 to 3 days to go to Malta. You've got 6 convoy doing probably 10 knots. You go, you're closed up to action stations. You're eating, sleeping, and doing whatever you can, where you can. Tension is built up. Then you're attacked by bombers. You fight ship. You're lucky. You know, you survive. The odd merchant ship's gone. One of your own fleet's gone, probably. Something like that. You go as far as you can, and then you turn back. Then, thank God, you come into Gibraltar. Sunday evening, 6:30. Life at that time was made up of ridiculous incidents for me. As the ship was coming into the harbour at Gib, I heard church bells. 6:30 on a Sunday evening, an English Sunday evening, and the cathedral was ringing the church bells. Here we'd just been 5 or 6 days at action stations. You know? Comforting thought. Anyway, go ashore. I went ashore that day. It was too late that night. Because surely he was given from 2 in the afternoon to 4 for the first watch, or the first and third watch, and 4 to 6 for the other after ship. I, being shipboard attendant, could choose my own. Went ashore at 4 o'clock, I think, in the afternoon, just to get a breath of air and a walk, probably visit the hospital, because sick berth attendants are very chummy, and if you were anywhere near a hospital or a sick bay, you would just go and have a chat, you know. Went down Main Street, first time in my life I'd ever been to Gibraltar. A beautiful summer's day again. Main Street, because the fleet was in, coming back from Malta, aircraft carriers, a couple of cruisers, half a dozen destroyers, you know, anything up to 4,000 men, 5,000 men ashore in the Main Street, Gibraltar. There's only one street in Gibraltar, Main Street. What's the name of the famous bars there? The Gut. Sister Street's Alexander. Down the Gut. The Egyptian Queen. The most famous pub in the last war, in the beginning of the last war, and in the First World War in the Mediterranean for the British Navy. The Egyptian Queen. You ask any old chief, does he remember the Egyptian Queen? And it undoubtedly was probably the most famous pub in the British Empire, because all the Mediterranean fleet, they would all flock to the Egyptian Queen. I don't know why it was called that. Well, I was going along Main Street looking for some place to eat, because you could get steak and chips coming over from, and eggs from the Spanish mainland, you see. You could have a good nosh-up, as they call it, and a drink of beer as well. Well, I was walking along Main Street. I think I may have had my meal, and a fight started. Within 5 or 10 minutes, Main Street in Gibraltar was a sea of fighting bodies. It had to be seen to be beheld. There must have been 2 or 3,000 British sailors laying into each other. Doing what? Letting off steam. Navy police couldn't do anything at all about it. All the Navy police were doing, if some rating was getting too bad, it started tearing up for civilian property, they would then move in and pick them out. And for a quarter of an hour, half an hour, a mass of seething bodies. You know, I got out of it. It wasn't my cup of tea. Though I must admit, I felt elated. Mass hysteria almost, unless you can control it. You know, that's why people go to dogfights and things. But you see 4,000 sailors doing the same thing. I was laughing. Bloody hell. There's nothing serious about it, really. They were just like not steam.